Hey, good evening, everybody. Let's cultivate our motivation. Especially think how fortunate we are to have met the Dharma, and not only to have met it, but to have interest in it, and not only to have interest, but to have faith that is based on conviction. In other words, not blind faith, but faith that comes about through knowledge and contemplation. That makes our interest very stable and our enthusiasm very stable. And so how fortunate we are to have those qualities which help to form the basis on which we can practice and make our life meaningful. And in particular, how fortunate we are to have interest in the Mahayana, to have some seed within us that cares about other sentient beings, and that at least aspires to care about them as much as, if not more than, we care about ourselves, and to attain enlightenment for their benefit. Just feel joy at this opportunity and then generate that bodhicitta motivation. So in cultivating motivation, I said how fortunate we are to have encountered the Mahayana teachings and to at least have some kind of interest in cherishing others as much as, if not more than, ourselves. And when I said that, one part of me was saying, oh, that sounds nice. Yeah? You're really going to cherish others more than me? I don't think so. Okay, so there's this self-centered thought inside that as much as we have respect and admiration for the bodhicitta, the self-centered thought really wants to stay in control of the show and doesn't want to give anything up. Yeah. Do you find that sometimes when you're trying to generate bodhicitta? Yeah. And that, you know, we just have this, you know, we hear about love and compassion for all sentient beings equally. We say, wow, that's so incredible. I really want to generate that. And then the next thought is, I want. Yeah? And when that thought comes in the mind that says, I want, is there, what, you know, do we have anything that can move that thought? You know? Or does that thought just, you know, it pitches its tent and it stays there until it gets what it wants? Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah? Just that thought. I want. I want this, or I want to get away from this. Yeah. But whatever it is, I want. And it seems like that's all there is in the entire universe at that moment. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's my, you know, when that thought of I want comes, there's nothing else in the universe, it seems like, besides that thought. And then, you know, this freak out we're going to have if we don't get what we want. You know, massive freak out. True. Yeah. So we could do some good skits about this one, I think. Yeah, how the self-centered mind thinks and how it operates and how it runs the show and, you know, how it comes up with all these arguments that seem very reasonable and rational until we vocalize them and try and say them to somebody else. And then we get a little bit embarrassed. And of course, when somebody else verbalizes, you know, the logic of their self-centered mind, we're going, what in the world are they thinking? This doesn't make any sense at all. And yet, our own self-centered mind, you know, it's right. It's right, and it's going to get its way no matter what. And so, and we suffer because of it, don't we? We suffer, and we make others suffer, and we create the cause for more suffering, and, you know, it's like we have the celebration of the cause of suffering. It's really too much. So, you know, this is, when we're talking about the defects of the self-centered thought, this is it. You know, this is the thing that we have to really nail. And when our self-centered thought is not getting what it wants, then to say, good. You know, self-centered thought, you have been the one who has been bothering me since time without beginning. Now your experience of suffering, you know, and use all of our ridicule, all of our nastiness, you know, and put it towards that self-centered thought. And remember that self-centered thought is not who we are. If you don't remember that, you're in big trouble. Okay, but you really have to separate that out. That self-centered thought is not who I am, but it's certainly making me miserable. So now it has some suffering? Great. I had a situation some years ago. This must have been 1987. And I was on pilgrimage in Tibet, and we were going on horseback to Lamo Lhotso, the Pelden Lamo's lake, where you climb up on this ridge and the lake is down in a valley, and when they're looking for the incarnation of the next Dalai Lama, they look in the lake and, you know, they can see syllables or houses, you know, pictures and things like that. So we were going there on horseback. It took us 2-3 days maybe from where we were. So my horse was very sweet, you know, a little bit slow, but very sweet. And there was one monk in our party, and his horse was really obstinate. And we were crossing one stream, and his horse would just stop in the middle of it and not move. You know, my horse was actually quite cooperative, very sweet. So he was getting pretty bummed out about it and in kind of a bad mood. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll just offer him my horse. I'll change horses with him. Because it was, you know, I didn't want him, he was really getting quite, So I offered him to change horses, and he got really mad at me. I don't know why, but he got really mad at me, and he started bringing out all these things, because we had known each other for a number of years. You know, here in this place you did this, and here in that place you did that, and here in that place you did that. And, Your friend even told me when you were in this place, you did this. And that friend told me when you were in that place, you did that. So he really had the police department after me. You know, here we are in Tibet, this incredible, spacious land, you know, on a pilgrimage to a holy lake. And he's telling me off about all these things that happened in various other countries where we had been. And for some reason, I think this was maybe the blessing of the pilgrimage, I had the idea of, okay, I'm just going to give all this criticism to my self-centered thought. So while he was sitting there, you know, telling me all these things I did wrong, I just, you know, I put, did forward, you know, like forward on your email, you know, so each one I forwarded to my self-centered thought. And I said, you know, this one's for you, and that criticism's for you, and that criticism's for you, and that one's for you, and take this one too, and don't forget that one. And I just kept giving them all to my self-centered thought, saying, I'm so glad he's criticizing, you know, because my self-centered thought deserves all of this. And so this went on, and for some miraculous reason, I was actually able to focus on that while he was going through all of this. He didn't take my horse. Eventually, you know, we got to the place where we were camping that night. And I'm usually so sensitive when people criticize me. You know, it's like, you know, just, I don't like getting criticized. But we got to our campsite, and I was in a good mood. I was like, fine, after this guy had torn into me. And I just realized, oh, this is the power of that practice of giving the suffering to the self-centered thought. It's kind of maybe the one and only time I've ever done a successful, you know, but it was very powerful. And so sometimes I do remember, you know, to do it again, and it's quite helpful. Yeah, but I was really surprised because evening came and I was in a fine mood and just didn't bother me at all that stuff he said. So, yeah. So give the pain to the self-centered thought because the self-centered thought is the originator, you know, the source, the birth mother of all of the suffering. So just give it. So somebody wrote a comment about the teachings. So I thought I would read this, some insightful things that she said. These teachings on the self-centered thought have been incredibly useful and have led to many a moment laughing at my own actions and thoughts and in trying to correct them these past weeks. And in seeing how incredibly self-centered they can be, even when I think I'm not being selfish and centered on self. You know how that one is? You think you're not being selfish and you're being really magnanimous, and then you look again and it's like all about me. I have also seen myself engage in the four types of behavior you described last week. Remember, being liked, being comfortable, being right, and winning. Okay. So I see myself engage in those four types of behavior, which upon reflection led me to make a connection between the four types to the first part of the four pairs in the eight worldly concerns. Okay. Yeah, so getting material possessions was correlated to winning. Okay. Getting praised was correlated to
being liked.
A good reputation was correlated to being right. Yeah, when you're right, you have a good reputation, don't you? Okay. And then wanting sense pleasures was correlated to being comfortable. Yeah, it was quite interesting how she correlated them. Isn't it? I notice especially how I turn a lot of things into a competition in some way, and even caught myself right in the act of trying to justify to myself how, although I didn't speak to someone, I really meant to speak to them and wasn't really judging them. And she has in parentheses, yeah, likely story again. What I really meant to do was, you know, that whole thing was how we justify things. Say, pretty much like you described last week. Okay, I think my awareness is improving as opposed to my behavior getting worse. Okay, so that's good, you know, our awareness of it. It's not that we're getting worse, it's just our awareness of what we're doing is becoming more acute. Okay, and I'm trying to get creative in various ways to cut off these old habits in mid-stride. Yeah. I thought that was quite nice. But very interesting correlating, you know, because the one about getting material objects and things, you know, winning, being competitive, that fits right in, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, of course, with praise, we want to be liked. Good reputation, we have to be right in order to have a good reputation. And then for sense pleasure is comfort. Mm-hmm. So there we are. Yeah. The four bases of, you know, on a basis, baseball season, isn't it, you know? Yeah. So first base, second base, yeah, you know, of our self-centered thought. Okay, so let's continue on with where we were. Okay, in addition, seeing sentient beings as the source of the cause and result of full awakening, they are all worthy of our highest respect. So remember last week we were talking about, you know, cherishing others because they are the source of our own enlightenment. So, you know, we can't get enlightened without them. And then also just our ability to stay alive day to day is dependent on others. And so they've been kind to us also in that respect. And so the same thing, the same text, which is the Gajra Bodhisattva's Way of Life, okay, says, even if, in order to pay respect to someone in whom a mere portion of good qualities of the unique collection of excellence exists, we were to present the three realms, it would be insufficient. Since all sentient beings have a portion of Buddha's supreme qualities, for this reason alone, sentient beings are worthy of respect. Okay? So, in order to pay respect to somebody who had not even all the good qualities of an enlightened one, but just a small portion of them, you know, if we were to offer that person the three realms, okay, desire, form, and formless, or you could say below the earth, on the earth, above the earth, in other words, the whole universe, all of samsara, if you were going to offer somebody with even a few small qualities all of samsara in order to show respect to them, okay, and doing that would actually be insufficient, yeah, because they just having a small bit of those qualities of the enlightened one, you know, how could you ever, like, show sufficient respect to somebody who had those? Okay. So that situation, and then since all sentient beings have a portion of Buddha's supreme qualities, for this reason alone, sentient beings are worthy of respect. Mm-hmm. So since sentient beings have even just a tiny portion, okay, so you're going to go, wait a minute, what tiny portion? I don't see any portion of the Buddha's good qualities in others or in myself. You know, well, yeah. This is the whole idea behind Buddha nature, is that we have the potential that can transform into the truth body of an enlightened one. Okay, so even just having the seeds of love and compassion, which do manifest in our mind as manifest consciousnesses, those are minds in accord with a Buddha's mind and form part of our Buddha potential. Okay, so everybody has those. There's nobody who is totally bereft of good qualities. And this is very, very important, you know, especially nowadays when there's all this thing of, you know, somebody's evil and irredeemable, the way we like to put labels on people. You know, somebody's irredeemable, somebody's evil, they're the devil incarnate, you know, all this kind of language. And from a Buddhist viewpoint, you can't say that at all. You know, nobody is inherently evil, nobody is inherently corrupt. Why? Because both the ultimate and the conventional nature of that person's mind is free of stains. Yeah. Or, you know, or put it this way, they're not free of stains at the moment, but the stains are adventitious. They aren't in the nature of that mind. Okay, so maybe not free of stains right now, but the stains are not the nature of the mind. Okay, so even this little mosquito here. Yeah. Yay. Gee. It is said that accomplishing the welfare and happiness of sentient beings gives rise to higher status and definite goodness. So what does higher status mean? A good rebirth. And what does definite goodness mean? Liberation or enlightenment. Okay. So accomplishing the welfare and happiness of sentient beings gives rise to both those results. So no matter whether you care about being happy in samsara or if your goal is to get out of samsara, cherishing others fulfills both of those. Yeah. In other words, you can't lose by cherishing others. Now, there's an important thing here about cherishing others that I think needs to be explained. And that is, cherishing others does not mean that you do everything everybody wants. Cherishing others is an attitude that we have in our own hearts and minds. You know, and it comes from seeing that our enlightenment depends on sentient beings, seeing that all of our happiness depends on sentient beings, seeing that they have just even a tiny portion of the good qualities of a Buddha. Okay? So we respect sentient beings. We have affection and care for them. And that's the mental attitude that we're trying to cultivate. How that mental attitude translates into action is going to depend upon the situation. And I really want to emphasize this because sometimes we get the thing of love and compassion means that I do everything everybody wants. Okay? So, you know, somebody wants to rape you and you say, it's okay, he needs it so badly. No, that's not okay. Okay? Or somebody beats you and you say, oh, it's okay, I forgive him. Well, no, it's not okay that somebody beats you. Or somebody who wants drugs or alcohol comes and says, give me some money, and you feel guilty for not giving them. You know, no, there's no reason to feel guilty for not giving money for if it's going to be used for a bad purpose. Okay? So it's this whole idea of having wisdom together with our compassion. So we have to remember that compassion means the wish for others to be free from suffering. So then we have to ask ourselves if our action is going to actually help that person be free from suffering, or if our action in an attempt to be a people pleaser is actually going to perpetuate that person's suffering. Okay, you getting what I mean? Yeah? So we really have to think about, you know, suffering not as just, you know, somebody's dissatisfied mind in fulfilling the wishes of their dissatisfied mind. We have to think in the long term of what's going to be of the greatest benefit to them and act that way. Okay? Yeah. And I really say this because otherwise we get this, you know, Mickey Mouse Bodhisattva. I think I told you about, we did this skit when I lived in France about Mickey Mouse Bodhisattva who, you know, opened up the coffers of the Dharma Center and gave them to all the drunks and, you know, and everything like that. You know, I have compassion here, take this, you know. And yeah, so we have to be quite aware of that. Okay. Whereas every kind of trouble arises from neglecting sentient beings. This is something to think about, you know, when our mind is in that thing of like, leave me alone. You know how the mind gets that way sometimes? Just leave me alone. I don't want to talk to anybody. Shut your mouth and leave me alone. Okay? And then you remember, whereas every kind of trouble arises from neglecting sentient beings. Yeah? Yeah. Think about that at that moment. Yeah? When you're trying to chase somebody away. Yeah? Every kind of suffering arises from neglecting sentient beings. So if I have an attitude that's hostile to somebody, you know, I'm certainly neglecting their welfare, aren't I? Or if I'm attached to them and I'm drawing them in to my little web of icky, gooey, sticky attachment, I'm also neglecting them, aren't I? Yeah? We usually think, oh, if I draw them in, I'm attached to them, then that's very good, you know, they love me, I love them. But, you know, is it really kindness when we have this icky, gooey, clingy attachment? Is that kindness to draw other people into it and to get them all involved in all of our trips? Yeah? It's not very kind, is it? You know how our icky, gooey, manipulative attachment is? What we do to other people to ensnare them? Yeah? And make them feel guilty when they don't do what we want them to do. Oh, we're good at that one. Yeah. Is that kindness? Okay. So, something to think about. Whereas every kind of suffering arises from neglecting sentient beings. So really neglecting their welfare from their side, not what they do for me. Or what they can do for me. Or what I'm going to make them do for me. Okay. In his commentary on the awakening mind, Nagarjuna states, "In this world, pleasant and miserable existences are the desired and unwanted results that arise respectively from helping or harming sentient beings." Okay? You know what I'm saying? So, pleasant existences is the desired result that arises from helping others. Miserable existence is the undesirable result that arises from harming others. Should you rely on sentient beings, you will gain the unsurpassable, fully awakened state. There is not a single person in the three realms. Well, let's go back to that. Should you rely on the sentient beings, you will gain the unsurpassable, fully awakened state. Pretty good, huh? There is not a single person in the three realms who has not taken birth as Brahma, Indra, or Vishnu, the protectors of the world, solely through helping sentient beings. What could be more marvelous than that? In other words, these Hindu gods who, you know, who the people who got that kind of rebirth from helping sentient beings, okay, then they got that through, you know, through helping. And so he's saying, what could be more marvelous than that? And I think the answer is full enlightenment and liberation, okay. But, you know, kind of enticing us with some worldly pleasure. We may not relate to wanting to be Indra and Vishnu, but, you know, if you think of the person you're most jealous of in the world that you want to have their power or wealth or pleasure or whatever, popularity. The many types of suffering experienced by sentient beings, as hell denizens, animals, and hungry spirits, arise from harming sentient beings. Yeah? So what created the three unfortunate realms of existence is hell beings, hungry ghosts, and animals. Yeah? The karma, the actions of harming sentient beings. And what mental state lies behind the action of harming sentient beings?
Ignorance.
Self-centered thought. You know, and of course ignorance, but here it's pointing to the self-centered thought. Okay. The miseries of hunger and thirst, eating one another and being overwhelmed by pains that are unrelenting and difficult to avoid, are the result of harming sentient beings. Okay, so the miseries of hunger and thirst are experienced by hungry ghosts. Okay, the suffering of eating one another,
animals,
and being overwhelmed by pain, hell beings. Okay, all of it is a result of harming sentient beings. Yeah, without exception. Yeah, in some way or another, even if you're harming the three jewels, it's indirectly harming sentient beings. Okay? So it's really the thing to remember all the time is whenever I harm somebody else, the one that I'm really harming is me. Yeah? So it's not just I'm angry and I want to get even with somebody for what they did to me. But when I do that, I'm giving myself a free ticket to the lower realms. Yeah? And so at that point, you know, we say, do I really want to give myself that as a birthday present? You know, a free ticket to a lower rebirth? No. You know, it's not worth it to harm somebody else because I'm mad at them or I'm feeling vindictive or, you know, I want to give them a taste of their own medicine and show them how I feel and all this kind of stuff that we use as reasons. Who's actually getting hurt in that process? Yeah, ourselves. Okay, so harming others and harming ourselves, there's no difference between them. Yeah, there's a superficial difference in terms of maybe who's bleeding right now and who's gloating, but in actual fact, harming somebody else is harming myself. Yeah, and to really feel that very strongly. Yeah. Whenever I harm somebody else, even just sitting there being angry at them, thinking negative thoughts about them, even, you know how we get sometimes? You're so mad at somebody. And spend a whole meditation session on thinking bad, nasty thoughts about somebody. You know, what are we putting into our own mind when we do that? You know, we're putting poison in our own mind. And does it feel good to think nasty, horrible, vindictive thoughts about somebody else? No, it doesn't feel good. Yeah? So why do we spend so much time doing what doesn't feel good if we want to be happy? Okay? So you can see right at the moment when we're harming somebody else. Right at that very moment, we're harming ourselves. And in addition, we're creating the karma for any of these bad rebirths. Okay? So then when you see it, then when you have to go in and do Vajrasattva or 35 Buddhas, then you have some energy, yeah, to actually do some purification. And instead of, you know, kind of either spacing out while you're doing it or thinking, oh, this person, they're saying the name's too slow. Or this person, they're saying the name's too fast. Or this person's not enunciating the names well enough. Or, you know, this person, they need to take a shower before they do prostrations. You know, so, you know, because you can spend your 35 Buddhas thinking about that, can't you? I'm sure you have. Yeah, you know, but like, why waste our time doing that? You know, when we look and we see, wow, I've created some negative karma. I have something to purify here, and I need to purify it quickly because I don't know when I'm going to die. Yeah, and so then if you have that sense of urgency in your practice, then you're not going to bother thinking about whether they're saying the names too fast or too slow, or if they skipped a name, or if they're, you know, going into too much detail when they're leading it and you wish they'd lead it quicker, or if they're not doing enough detail and you're lost. Yeah, you won't bother kind of having those type of thoughts.
Look in the window every now and then.
A person of the fundamental vehicle does not attain even a part of full awakening because he neglects sentient beings. Whereas a follower of the great vehicle, since he is deeply concerned for others, actualizes unsurpassable Buddhahood. I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration, with all due respect to Namgyalpa, our author. I think little exaggeration. I think he's doing it for a purpose, to really emphasize to us the importance of, you know, generating bodhicitta. But I don't think you can say that a person of the fundamental vehicle doesn't attain even a part of full awakening. Yeah. Because when we just said a little bit before that all sentient beings have, you know, some aspect of awakening. But, you know, and because he neglects sentient beings, I don't think we can say that people from the fundamental vehicle neglect sentient beings. They generate love and compassion. Not the same love and compassion as bodhisattvas do. Okay? And not the great resolve and not the bodhicitta. But they definitely generate love and compassion. And I've been in situations where the quote-quote Mahayana people are less helpful than the quote-quote Hinayana people. So I think we shouldn't engage in that kind of, you know, discussion of putting others down. Okay. But the point here is, let us remain focused on the great love and great compassion of bodhicitta. That's the point. Okay. The same text says, you should vigorously reject as if it were poison a lack of affection for sentient beings. Yeah. We should have some of these posted around the house, shouldn't we? Yeah. Okay. You should vigorously reject as if it were poison a lack of affection for sentient beings. Yeah. So that's, remember I told you the story of His Holiness asking the monk who was imprisoned in the Chinese prisons what he feared the most, and he said losing his compassion for his captors. Yeah, which is just amazing. So here it's expressing that same idea, you know, that the worst thing to do, the thing you want to reject the most, the thing you're most afraid of, yeah, is losing your affection for sentient beings. Because you see that affection for sentient beings is the basis upon which you develop all of the qualities of a fully enlightened Buddha. Yeah, you don't have a Buddha who is full of resentment and anger and revenge. Yeah. So if we have any of those kind of mental states, we have to see them for what they are and see that they're going against what we really want to develop in our lives. Since hearers lack such a feeling, won't they attain an inferior enlightenment? Like I said before, that those in the here and solitary realize their vehicle, they do cultivate love and compassion, not to the degree that the bodhisattvas do. So it's in that way that they lack that feeling. And they do attain an inferior enlightenment in the sense that they remove the arhats, remove only the afflictive obscurations, not the cognitive obscurations. So they don't have the omniscient mind that can be of the greatest benefit to all beings. As those who never completely forsake sentient beings will attain the enlightenment of complete awakening, how could those who examine the results of harming or helping others remain attached for a single instant to their own welfare? So when you see the benefit, okay, of helping others and the disadvantages of harming them, okay, and you see that those who don't forsake sentient beings attain the highest enlightenment, and you really see the qualities of that enlightenment and the wonderful things that you can do for others and how you feel yourself as an enlightened being. So seeing, you know, what the qualities of a Buddha are and knowing that you can attain them and knowing that helping others leads to attaining those qualities and that state of enlightenment, then why would we remain attached for even a single instant to our own welfare? Yeah? That sounds pretty foolish, doesn't it? Okay. So whether we're combating the gross self-centeredness, which is the one that lies behind the eight worldly concerns, okay, that gross kind of self-centeredness, or the self-centeredness that is attached to the bliss of meditative equipoise and, you know, just wants to hang out in samsara and experience that bliss. So, you know, that's a kind of gross self-centeredness. And then there's a subtler self-centeredness. A subtler self-centeredness that is oriented on my enlightenment. Okay? Like, okay, maybe we all have Buddha nature, but I want my enlightenment. Yeah? And the best thing I can do for others and myself is get myself out of cyclic existence, so I'm focusing on my enlightenment, and I wish others well, but I'm going to get out of samsara, because this place is a hellhole. Okay? So, it can be very easy to fall into that, actually. You know, sometimes when you look at what bodhisattvas have to do and the merit they have to accumulate to attain full enlightenment, sometimes the mind can go, that's just too hard. You know, I want to get out of samsara already. It's too hard to attain full enlightenment. And why should I spend all that time creating all that merit for these sentient beings who don't even appreciate what I'm doing for them? You know? What a waste of my time and energy. It sounds rational and reasonable, doesn't it? You know, somebody doesn't appreciate what I'm doing, well, go away. I'm getting enlightened by myself. Too bad, buddy. Okay? We can see how our mind would do that. Yeah? So we have to be very careful that our mind doesn't do that. Yeah? And that our mind really stays committed to helping sentient beings because they've been kind to us in the past and our enlightenment depends on them and all these other reasons. Okay? Not because they dote on us and say thank you and please and these kinds of things. Yeah? And praise us and appreciate us and say how good we are. Okay, those aren't the reasons why we care for sentient beings. Why? Because if we care for sentient beings because they say nice pleasing words to us, what happens when they don't say nice pleasing words? Yeah, our love and compassion is gone. You know, if we care about sentient beings because they give us presents, then what happens when they don't? We care about sentient beings because they look at us with loving eyes and say, you're the most wonderful thing in the world, or, you know, you're the most gorgeous thing in the world, the most intelligent thing in the world, you know, whatever they say, and that's why we love them. Then what happens when they don't say that? Yeah? No more love, no more compassion. Dried up. Okay? So we have to really look, what are the reasons why we care about sentient beings? And be very, very clear on what the reasons are, why they are valid objects of our love and compassion. Okay? This is really quite important. Because if we have we love them, but for these other kind of reasons associated with the eight worldly dharmas, that love is actually attachment, and it's also going to evaporate as soon as sentient beings don't do that behavior, which is guaranteed that they're going to stop doing. Okay? Because who's going to be nice to us 100% of the time? Yeah, nobody. So if we love them because they're nice to us, then when they aren't, we're going to hate them. Okay? So we have to have these other reasons why we see sentient beings as lovable, because these other reasons aren't dependent on how they're acting towards us right now. Okay? And so these other reasons are always going to hold, and so we'll always be able to keep our love and compassion for them. It's similar to when we're trying to develop self-confidence. If we develop self-confidence based on our looks, our intelligence, our job, our money, our popularity, our talents, that's not a valid basis for self-confidence, for long-term self-confidence anyway, because all those qualities are going to decay after a while. But if we have self-confidence because we have the Buddha potential, that's never going to decay. And no matter what state our body and mind is in, we still have that Buddha potential. And that can be a valid basis for self-confidence. Okay? So really checking our reasonings, our reasons, I should say. Yeah? The harm sentient beings presently appear to be doing us is fundamentally caused by the disturbing emotions in our own mind streams over beginningless time. You're going to go, what? The harm sentient beings presently, and the author says, appear to be doing to us, we're going to say, are doing to me. Okay. You're telling me that the harm other people do to me is fundamentally caused by my mental afflictions that have existed in my mind stream since beginning this time? No way. Their harm is due to their mental afflictions. I'm just sweet, innocent, sweet me. Okay? So in what way is the harm that they appear to be giving us due to our own afflictions? How does that work?
We're experiencing the result of our negative karma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're experiencing the results of our negative karma in the form of other people who seem to be harming us. And also our present afflictions are interpreting their actions in a very negative way. You know, as we were talking about, the people may be trying to help us, and we see it as harm. Yeah? So who's responsible for that? When people are trying to help us, and we think they're harming us? Okay. That's our mind, isn't it? Our afflictions. So that's how the harm that we appear to be receiving is basically due to our own afflictions. Okay, in those two ways. The way we're interpreting it, and of course, we created the karma that we're experiencing the result of. The auxiliary conditions are the tendencies remaining from actual harm we have done against sentient beings over beginningless time. Okay, so the auxiliary conditions are the karmic seeds. Yeah, the tendencies remaining from the harm we've given to others, in other words, the karmic seeds of negative actions. Those are the auxiliary conditions. And due to the activation of such causes and conditions, in other words, our afflictions and our karma, our negative karma, those who harm us are motivated by evil thoughts, for which reason they engage in numerous cruel and misguided actions against us. Okay, let me continue on. This is an unusual argument. In general, throughout limitless cyclic existence, the blame for our experience of various miseries, such as those of the three bad rebirths in particular, rests with our self-centered attitude. As the exalted Shantideva has said, having been provoked by my actions, harm befalls me. If by their involvement sentient beings are thrown into hell, am I not destroying them? Okay, so what this whole section is saying, yeah, is I have afflictions in my mind. I've done negative actions towards others. So there's a negative, the seeds of negative actions in my mind stream that leave me ripe and ready to experience the negative actions of others. Okay, by me being ripe and ready to experience the negative actions done, to be the object of negative actions done by others, I'm setting up sentient beings for doing negative actions. I'm providing the circumstance through which their own negative minds can arise, and so that they create negative karma. And so by them creating negative karma in relationship to me, aren't I sending them to the hell realm? Okay, are you getting what this is saying? Now somebody's going to say, wait a minute, this sounds like blaming the victim. You're telling me if somebody else does a negative action that I'm to blame for their negative action? That I'm sending them to hell when they beat me and trash me and speak cruelly about me and rip my stuff off? You're telling me it's my fault? That's blaming the victim. Don't do that. So it sounds like, doesn't it? Okay, so we have to remember here, we are not blaming the victim. Yeah? We're not blaming our conventional self. We are blaming the self-centered thought. We are blaming the afflictions. Okay? So then it's that whole thing of saying, by me being afflicted, by me creating negative karma, I provide the setup for other people to generate negative states of mind, and in that way I'm sending them to the lower realms. And here I am trying to develop love and compassion for others, but because I don't take care of my own actions, and I allow myself either to become the object of somebody else's negative actions, or I spark their negative actions intentionally, then aren't I harming somebody when I'm saying that actually what I want to do is help them? Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? Okay. So this kind of way of thinking, it's not blaming the victim. We're thinking this way for a very specific reason, in order to show, because he's moving into a section of how to handle our anger against sentient beings. Because usually when we're angry at sentient beings, he did that, and he did that, and on and on and on and on. You know, this one beat me, this one's talking bad about me, this one betrayed my trust, this one did this to me, this one did that to me. You know, but thinking that way gets us absolutely nowhere. But if we look at the karmic situation, why am I being the object of somebody else's negative actions? Because I did some kind of negative action myself in a previous life, motivated by my self-centered thought. Okay? And so, in doing so, I'm providing the setup for this person's negative actions. So what? You know, here I am saying I want all sentient beings to be well and happy, but actually I'm getting very mad at somebody. But meanwhile, they're going to experience a bad rebirth because of what they're doing to me. So why in the world should I get mad at somebody who's going to experience a bad rebirth because of the harm they're giving me. Okay, that's the concluding way that you lead your mind. It's like, here I am getting mad at somebody, but why? You know? Because they're going to, you know, they're doing this negative stuff. They're accumulating negative karma in relationship to me. Yeah. Do I really want to wish somebody a bad rebirth? No. Okay, so what's the use of getting mad at somebody? Even though they're acting in this way to me, isn't it them that's going to suffer from this kind of behavior in the long term? So why be mad at them? Okay? Yeah. Seems reasonable, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So it's true. You know, I was thinking about this actually in relationship to somebody who was not treating me very well. And I was just thinking, wow, you know, this person has so much potential as a human being, but the characteristic in them that I seem to be invoking is going to be blocking so many good deeds that they can do. Yeah. So I'm not saying it's my fault, okay, but it's like, wow, what a tragedy that this person has so much potential and can do so much good, but this characteristic, which is the thing that, you know, they're showing to me right now that's causing harm, is preventing them from doing so much good that they could do for others, which I really would like them to be able to do. Yeah? Okay. Okay, maybe time for one or two questions. Yeah.
So, let's say someone's trashing us in some very harsh words, so that they don't continue with this harm to themselves.
Okay. Okay, so if somebody's trashing us and saying very, very harsh words, and we see that they're creating negative karma by doing this, and they're going to experience a bad rebirth, and we don't want that for them, what's the best thing to do? Okay. It depends a lot on the situation. Yeah, you have to assess the situation yourself and see what the best thing to do is. Because yeah? Sometimes, you know, each situation you have to be very creative with. Because, you know, if somebody's under the influence of a negative emotion, you can't snap your fingers and make it go away and make them stop being angry. Yeah? So you have to see in the situation, you know, at least don't do anything to deliberately provoke them and inflame them anymore. You may not be able to calm them down, but at least don't provoke them. And they may just need to, you know, get all their stuff out and then, you know, have a reasonable discussion with them and try and work it out. Yeah? So you have to see what, you know, how to handle each situation. So I'm not going to say, oh, just tell them they're right. Because that's not going to necessarily help them or stop their anger. Okay?
Mm-hmm. So I found that that works really well when it's flare up, you know, it's just kind of out of the normal situation.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's a habitual, I've seen I where I'm the one perceiving it, and that my afflictions are perceiving it, but the situation is repetitive, and so there's this fear that arises, mm-hmm. that creates this dislike that's also not beneficial because it goes to that neglect place, but I don't know how this works.
Okay, so when it's a habitual situation with somebody where they flare up in the same way or they do the same negative action towards you, and then you find that you're getting afraid of them and afraid of that situation, then I think we have to look and see, how am I contributing to that situation? Yeah? Because, you know, is there some behavior of mine that I'm habitually doing that is really acting as a trigger for this person? Is there some way that I, you know, come on to them or greet them or something that is pushing a button that I'm just totally unaware of. Yeah. And so, because whenever there's these habitual things, and it happens in families a lot, doesn't it? It's like you have to think, you know, look at the dynamic, because it always seems to be the other person. Yeah. But look at, you know, well, what am I doing? Yeah. Am I always, you know, saying I'm going to do something and then not doing it? I mean, what's the situation that they're always getting so upset about me? Upset with me about? Am I saying I'm going to do something and not doing it? Or saying I'm going to give them something by such and such a time and then I'm always delayed? Or I say I'm going to meet them and then I don't show up? Or if I say I really care about them but then I leave all the garbage, you know, for them to clean up? Is there a situation that's happening repetitively between us, you know, where that I'm contributing in some way to that maybe I could change? Yeah. And there might be. Or there might not be. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Let's sit quietly and think about this. Actually, we offer the mandala and we think about it afterwards.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the ten directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may it stay until samsara ends. May the deed of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the ten directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Glory.